America entered World War II on December 8, 1941, the day before Japan had attacked Pearl Harbor. Now, barely a month later, President Roosevelt gives his State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress.
The militarists of Berlin and Tokyo started this war, but the massed, angered forces of common humanity will finish it. Destruction of the material and spiritual centers of civilization. This has been, and still is, the purpose of Hitler and his Italian and Japanese chessmen. They would wreck the power of the British Commonwealth and of Russia and of China and of the Netherlands, and then combine all their forces to achieve their ultimate goal, the conquest of the United States. They know that victory for us means victory for freedom. They know that victory for us means victory for the institution of democracy, the ideal of the family, the simple principles of common decency and humanity. They know that victory for us means victory for religion, and they could not tolerate that. The world is too small to provide adequate living room for both Hitler and God. In proof of that, the Nazis have now announced their plan for enforcing their new German pagan religion all over the world, the plan by which the Holy Bible and the Cross of Mercy would be displaced by Mein Kampf and the swastika and the naked sword. Our own objectives are clear. The objective of smashing the militarism imposed by warlords upon their enslaved peoples. The objective of liberating the subjugated nations. The objective of establishing and securing freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear everywhere in the world. We shall not stop short of these objectives, nor shall we be satisfied merely to gain them and then call it a day. I know that I speak for the American people, and I have good reason to believe that I speak also for all the other peoples who fight with us when I say that this time we are determined not only to win the war, but also to maintain the security of the peace that will follow. But we know that modern methods of warfare make it a task not only of shooting and fighting, but an even more urgent one of working and producing. Victory requires the actual weapons of war and the means of transporting them to a dozen points of combat. It will not be sufficient for us and the other United Nations to produce a slightly superior supply of munitions to that of Germany and Japan and Italy and the stolen industries in the countries which they have overrun. The superiority of the United Nations in munitions and ships must be overwhelming. So overwhelming, the Axis nations can never hope to catch up with it. And so in order to attain this overwhelming superiority, the United States must build planes and tanks and guns and ships to the utmost limit of our national capacity. We have the ability and capacity to produce arms, not only for our own forces, but also for the armies, navies, and air forces fighting on our side. And our overwhelming superiority of armament must be adequate to put weapons of war at the proper time into the hands of those men in the conquered nations who stand ready to seize the first opportunity to revolt against their German and Japanese oppressors and against the traitors in their own ranks known by the already infamous name of Quislings. And I think that it is a fair prophecy to say that as we get guns to the patriots in those lands, they too will fire shots heard round the world.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and we're listening to Eric Higgins, who is a TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. And he's talking about how media uses the fear and prejudices of their viewers to garner a larger audience.
Unfortunately, our news media doesn't cover poverty very much. So when you have somebody like Mitt Romney speaking to a bunch of wealthy donors and saying that 47% of the country just wants to get free stuff from the government and is not going to vote for him, one reason why he might say that and one reason why people might believe it is because media has not told them about the poor. The working poor, the people that he's talking about, the 47% of people who don't pay federal income tax, they're working at Walmart. They're working at McDonald's. They might be working at UPS or at a grocery store. Maybe they have two jobs. Maybe they're taking the bus or riding the bike to get to work. And we know how much work it is to get around when you don't have a car, right? Sometimes being poor is a lot of hard work, thank you very much. But people don't know that sometimes because the media doesn't tell them. I used as an important source this book called Why Americans Hate Welfare by Martin Gilens, a great professor at Princeton University, who wrote this book trying to dig into why people are so people reject the word welfare. Like if you ask people their opinions about welfare, which is this catch-all term that describes a bunch of different programs that are arrayed to help people in poverty, if you ask them about welfare, you often get a lot of negative reactions. But if you ask people about the programs that are the components of welfare, they'll often say they like a lot of stuff in it. And one of the things he found was that media coverage may have associated black people with welfare in a way that has encouraged people to reject the term overall. So he looked at coverage of general poverty in Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News in stories from 1967 to 1992, 25 years, and he found black people were 57% of the poor shown in those stories. So general stories about poverty could have just a general thing, no race involved. Black people were 57% of the people shown, and that was twice the rate of black poverty at the time. And in 1972 and 1973, black people were shown as 75% of the welfare stories. Now, I think, I want to believe, that that happened out of a genuine, altruistic decision to try and depict people of color in poverty more and talk about those issues. But what ends up happening is black folks get associated with welfare beyond their proportions in these public programs. And that, unfortunately, aids people who want to dismiss them and want to turn away from them. I talk about two definitions to remember when we're dissecting this stuff. Confirmation bias, which is a tendency to search for and interpret information in a way that confirms your preconceptions, leading to statistical errors. This comes from the world of science. So if you start an experiment and you feel like you already know how it's going to turn out, then you'll mostly pay attention to the evidence that supports the conclusion that you already have in mind. And that distorts the experiment, right? But when we talk about prejudice and stereotypes, if you have a sense that you already know what somebody's like, or you already know what people are, what certain types of people are like, then you're only going to pay attention to the evidence that supports that conclusion. So confirmation bias is something that can be at work in a lot of this reporting. Actor-observer bias is even more interesting. And I thought about it like when I'm driving, right? If I'm driving and I'm breaking the speed limit and driving really fast, it's because I'm late for an appointment, right? Or I'm late for work. Or the person in front of me is driving too slow or whatever, right? But if somebody else is driving really fast at a time when I don't want to drive fast, well, that person's unsafe. That person's a jerk. Actor-observer bias is attributing your own actions to external causes, but blaming other people for their own misfortunes. So if you're struggling to pay the bills, it's because it's a tough economy out there, and it's hard to get a good paying job, and the field that you're trained for just doesn't have a lot of openings. But when other people have trouble paying their bills and they're in poverty, well, they made a bad decision. They're not working hard enough. They're lazy, right? That's actor-observer bias. And what do confirmation bias and actor-observer bias have in common? It's context. That's like our job as journalists, providing context. But often what happens with these outlets that are distorted by prejudice, stereotypes, is the context is missing or the context is distorted. And then confirmation bias and actor-observer bias take hold, and the next thing you know, you've got an inaccurate account. How did my book get its name? Well, like I said, my good friend, Bill O'Reilly, right? My goal, though, in writing this book was to reclaim the word race baiter. I feel like we have all of these thoughts and terms and concepts about race that are implicit. They operate at the edges of our consciousness. They're things that we indulge almost without thinking about them. And what I want to do is I want to make them explicit. I want to draw them out to the light. I want people to talk about them, contemplate them, and really decide whether or not they make sense. And so for me, reclaiming the word race baiter means getting people to do that. If I can get people to think, you know, one of the great achievements of the civil rights era is that open racism is mostly rejected now. You can't just walk up to me and call me the N-word in public and have people clap, right? So that means that if we can get people to think about this stuff in the open and consider it, then maybe they'll reject it. So that is pretty much my presentation. If you guys have any questions or any comments, I'd be happy to entertain them right now. Do we have some questions, comments? Thank you.
Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue. They couldn't believe it when I said yes. And then I said, you ain't heard nothing yet. We are based in Washington, D.C., a truly diverse community. Almost 600,000 strong have been exploited much too long. Inadequate power over our own affairs and national issues for which we care. No votes in Congress, the Senate, the House, no state delegation, no representation. We pledge allegiance, my country, 'tis of thee. Fight in wars, pay taxes in this country. Provide work and services for the government. We get no vote, but our money is spent. You may wonder, how in the world can this be? I thought we lived in a democracy. The U.S. Constitution gives equal protection. Check the 14th Amendment to make this connection. No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. Oh well, no representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. In 1787, the U.S. Constitution was ratified. U.S. Congress won the power to exclusively exercise. In all cases, legislation over the future capital of this nation. In 1790, selection of the district site began. Using a piece of Virginia and a piece of Maryland, forming the District of Columbia or Washington, D.C. But the people kept on voting in their former states, you see. In 1800, Congress took control of D.C. Ended representation for the whole community. In the history of this country, you will find the reason why. And even in the new millennium, they want this law to apply. In 1846, the portion of D.C. from Virginia decided to retrocede. It was returned to the original state line. Alexandria and Arlington came after this time. In 1871, an elected delegate with no vote was created for the House of Representatives. No joke. D.C. was given territorial government that year. Representation remained an issue, do you hear? In 1874, financial troubles arise. The position of non-voting delegate meets its demise. The territorial government that was given to D.C. was taken back by Congress at this point of history. In 1970, the House brings the position back. Years of civil rights activism brought the pressure with no slack. A step in the right direction brought the people so much joy. And the man in this position
nation was Walter Fauntleroy. In 1978, Congress finally said okay to the D.C. Voting Rights Act, but not right away. If approved within 7 years or with no hesitation, D.C. would be granted full representation. In 1985, our hopes were really, really high. We knew that they should not let this bill die. All we needed was approval of 38 states, but only 16 states would support our case.
And the exploitation continues.
In 1993, the district made a giant step. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton worked hard to get a D.C. vote on the House floor, which Congress did approve. But when Republicans came to power, the decision was overruled. No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. Oh well, no representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Now I'm sure you're wondering what can be done. There are at least four ways that this fight can be won. Some suggest we virtual seat as a part of Maryland, become a city or a county in that state once again. Or a new law could pass with a congressional vote. D.C. residents would be counted in the Maryland vote for federal election census taking without virtual seating back. This would leave our residency intact. Or Congress could pass another law for D.C. like they did in 1800 when they took over totally. For more than 500 reasons, they treat us like a state, and adding another reason should not a problem create. This would give us 2 U.S. Senate seats, and the census would determine the number of House seats. Preferably D.C. would be the 51st state. We have a seat in the House and 2 in the Senate. It's not too late. Democracy is what we want. Voting rights are what we need. Tell your congressperson it's time to take heed. Democracy is what we want. Voting rights are what we need. Tell your congressperson it's time to take heed. No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. Oh well, no representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote right now. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.
I think you touched on this briefly a little bit. But I'm primarily print focused, and one thing that I have a hard time understanding is this idea that some of our commentators or television news reporters are sort of allowed, for lack of a better term, to have the sort of opinions and that sort of thing that maybe Al Sharpton has, that we know that he has. Right. And I'm talking about people who sort of began their careers as journalists and continue to be journalists. Can you comment a little bit on this kind of culture in cable news, I guess, of having these opinions, I guess?
Sure. I actually think, forgive me if there's any Fox News fans in the audience, but I'm going to blame Fox News for this too, because, I said 95% of what happens in media is about somebody making money or somebody losing money. So when the Fox News channel was being birthed and sort of developed, the idea was, how do you compete with CNN, right? And CNN has bureaus all over the world. They're the place everybody turns to when a breaking news is going on. They made their bones reporting from Iraq during the first Iraq war. How do you compete with that? Well, the way you compete with that is you don't report the news. You talk about the news. You talk about the news that everybody else already knows. And as media gets more and more fractured, as it gets more and more put out on smartphones and websites, it's more and more likely that by the end of the day, at 7 o'clock, or 8 o'clock, or 9 o'clock, everybody already knows the news of the day. So you need somebody who can talk about the news in a really compelling way. And that's what Fox does really well. And now, all of a sudden, that's the template for getting people to watch cable news shows when the news is not that compelling. And you can't really talk about the news unless you express an opinion about the news. I mean, you kind of have to do that. So that's why we are where we are. And some people will say that these people are not journalists, which is what MSNBC often says. They say that Al Sharpton's not a journalist, Rachel Maddow's not a journalist, Lawrence O'Donnell's not a journalist. But you know what? They're in a suit, and they're sitting at a desk, and they got that graphic over their right shoulder or over their left shoulder, and they're telling us what happened that day. So they look like journalists. And frankly, they're hoping that you give them the same credibility that you give journalists. So it's journalism-ish, right? Well, journalism-ish. You can use that. Feel free.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your talk, and I have a bit of a long question. I'm going to go ahead with some trepidation and ask like the big question on media that's been on my mind for a while. So you've talked about how narrowcasting toward, you know, specific niches is what in part helps create these stereotypes about minority groups in our media and our culture. So do you think the solution is for journalism to return to a bit more broadcasting at larger audiences, something that could be considered more objective or accurate, whatever that means, or do stereotypes perpetuate themselves in old media as well, and perhaps new media has the advantage of letting us see perspectives that would have been out of the mainstream or marginalized in old media?
Yeah, well, I would refer back to what I said earlier, which is 95% of what happens in media is somebody's making money or somebody's losing money, right? I don't want to sound like a broken record, but that's it. So going back to the old media model is probably not going to happen because people can't make money that way anymore, right? Increasingly, I mean, NBC right now is getting the kind of ratings that put it below Univision in the 18 to 49 viewers, right? It's in fifth place right now. In a four-person race, it's in fifth place, right? So we're reaching the point where broadcasting is increasingly hard to do. So I don't think that's going to come back. But what I do think, I mean, this whole book is premised on the idea that I'm not going to be able to convince these media outlets to stop doing what they're doing because they're making money doing it. I don't know if you saw the Project for Excellence in Journalism released its State of the News Media report, and I don't know if you looked at the profits the cable news channels were making, but Fox News made $1.8 billion, and CNN made $1.1 billion. You know, they ain't going back. But what I'm trying to do is convince you guys, the audience, to change how you see what they're doing. And when you change how you see what you're doing, and you change how you respond to what they're doing, then they have to change what they're doing, right?
There is some sort of bottom-up process
totally.
As well that we could change, the audience can change what is being marketed to us.
Totally.
Rather than,
I mean, the great thing about the way media is going, the great thing about the fragmentation of media is that it takes power from the gatekeepers and it distributes it down, right? And the gatekeepers have less control and you have much more control, right? I mean, we were just talking about this a second ago, right? When MASH, that finale aired, you better watch it when it was on CBS. Because there was no other way to see it unless, if you were lucky, they reran it like 6 months later. Yes, young people, that happened. Right? You couldn't even record it on VHS until like 10 years or 15 years after it was on television, right? Now it's to the point where if you didn't see the Academy Awards when they aired on that Sunday night, they had it up on the internet less than a day later. And really, you could just watch all the clips people put on YouTube like 10 minutes after the show was over, right? So all of a sudden, everybody in the audience has much more freedom and power over that presentation. They can take, you know, Seth MacFarlane's joke about, you know, we saw your boobs and put it on YouTube, and then everybody can put their little comments about why they think it's cool or why they think it's sexist or whatever. And ABC, you know, they can ask YouTube to take down the video, but they don't really have a lot of control over that process, right? So I think my only hope is to convince you guys to make them change what they're doing.
Listen, children, to a story that was written long ago about a kingdom on a mountain and the valley folk below. People swore they'd have it for their very own. Go ahead and hit your neighbor. Go ahead and cheat your friend. Do it in the name of heaven. Justify it in the end. There won't be any trumpets blowing come the judgment day on the bloody morning after. One tin soldier rides. Of the hill, as
asking for the very treasure, tons of gold for which they kill. Came an answer from the kingdom, with our brothers we will share all the secrets of our mountain, all the riches buried there. On earth was all it said.
Now for something completely different.